history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some men and women around you, seemingly ordinary Americans with extraordinary stories to tell, and we're privileged to hear them here each week. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn so much. We are educated. We're always entertained and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Waterford, Wisconsin. A little more than 5,000 people live here. It's a pretty drive through rolling hills, grain silos, a little fresh fallen snow as I made the trip here to see Ken Vincent, who's turning 95 years old. He's lived in this part of the country for his entire life, except for the 4 years where the Army sent him halfway around the world. And we're going to hear about his experiences in the 3rd Armored Division in Europe during World War II. But before we get over there, let's talk about growing up in Milwaukee during the Great Depression. What do you remember about those years, Ken?
One of the things I remember is that my dad used to have a favorite expression. He couldn't buy a job. They would pay my dad sometimes half in cash and half in poultry. And one time someone gave him a runty pig. They'd pay him with eggs and things of this nature.
A lot of bartering going on.
Yes, a lot of bartering.
So did that pig become your pet or your dinner?
It started out as a pet, and then it ended up as our dinner.
And you were an only child, so that was probably your buddy. That must have been tough on you.
Well, I had a couple of close buddies. In those days, it was all farms, what is now the city of Franklin. In those days, Franklin was a township. Now there isn't a single farm in any of those areas. They're now cities. The city of Franklin, the city of Oak Creek, and so on.
And Milwaukee now is a big giant city with a Major League Baseball team and an NBA basketball team. But back then, none of that was there. What was the big attraction in Milwaukee?
Beer.
And you said your dad couldn't buy a job. But you found some jobs as a very young boy. How early did you start playing the accordion?
Well, see, my folks started giving me accordion lessons when I was 8 years old.
Uh-huh.
And by the time I was 12, I was playing, quote-unquote, professionally in honky-tonky taverns.
Uh-huh.
My dad would drive me to these places. He'd buy a beer and then sit way in the back. He just wanted to make sure that I got my money, you know. As I got older, I played in nicer places. I played downtown a lot in Milwaukee, some of the ritzy hotels where they wanted cocktail music. They didn't want polkas and waltzes. I stayed with that until New Year's Eve of 41, because the 3rd of January, I went into the service.
Because something significant had happened about 3 weeks earlier, and I want to talk to you about that. But I want to make sure I really understand who you were way back then, too. So you start playing the accordion at 8. You're playing professionally at 12. Is it safe to guess that your ambitions, if there hadn't have been a war or anything like that, that your ambitions were lined up with music?
Yes. I had a dream. And they all say everything that we have starts out with a dream. I wanted to own a music store someday and have music teachers coming in there. But, of course, that went by the wayside. After I came out, I went to school under the GI Bill, got married in June of 46 to my childhood sweetheart. I was very fortunate there. I met my wife actually in first grade.
Woo.
We both went to a rural country school, probably 50 kids, I think, in the whole school, 2 teachers, 2 classrooms, and 4 grades to a classroom. Often in later years, we used to kid each other and say that we had such a good marriage, which we did, by the way, because we got our fighting out of our system when we were kids. And boy, we fought when we were kids. And I've got this a scar to prove it.
Scar on your forehead?
We were walking home from school one night, and my wife, her name was Mert, short for Myrtle. Mert was walking in front of me with a boy whom I detested with all my heart. And the feeling was mutual. And I was pulling on her apron strings. See, in those days, girls didn't wear slacks like they do today. They always wore skirts. I was pulling on her apron strings, trying to undo that bow that she had. And she swung around with her lunchbox and caught me right here with her lunchbox. And oh, how the blood flowed. And I ran home through the fields, and I told my folks that a boy threw a rock and I didn't duck fast enough. I couldn't admit what had happened. Well, many years later, my wife and I and our two kids were in the living room. We were at my folks' house. The four of us were sitting around the kitchen table playing cards. Somehow the topic came up, and that's when I thought, this is a good time to tell them the truth. Well, I thought my mother and dad would fall off their chairs roaring with laughter. They just were convulsed with laughter. And to think that Mert got one over on Kenny.
Well, and you never would have come back to marry Mert had you not survived 4 years in the Army during World War II. I got to ask you, though, what was the point at which Mert went from enemy to ally? When did you start to think, hey, this is a girl that I might want to marry someday?
I was in basic training down at Camp Polk, Louisiana, and one day I got a letter in the mail at mail call, and I didn't recognize the handwriting on the envelope, and then I looked at the return address, couldn't believe the name there. I opened it up naturally. Well, here it was, a letter from Mert, telling me all about her life, what she was doing, and so forth. Nothing romantic at all, not at that point in time. So I thought, well, I always had a hidden burning in my heart for her, even when I went with other girls in high school. So I responded. Pretty soon, you know, I got a letter back from that one in response. We kept writing back and forth, back and forth. Gradually, I think we eased in the fact that we both liked each other. I think that's the way it came out. And then when I came out, why, naturally, we went together with serious intent. So in June of 46, why, we decided to make it official. She passed away in February from cancer. Darn, cancer is horrible. Had she made it until June of that year, we would have been married 65 years.
Well, good thing that she slugged you in the face with a lunchbox. Left an impression on you.
I sure did.
Literally.
Literally.
Well, everybody that I've talked to, hundreds and hundreds of veterans that I've interviewed, everybody seems to remember something about December 7th, 1941. Do you remember how you found out what happened?
Oh, yes. I had been out the night before on a playing job. A lot of times I play jobs went until 1 o'clock in the morning or a little bit later. But anyway, I got home after one. Naturally, my folks weren't up yet, so I quietly went to my bedroom and went to sleep, and always woke up late, and I came down, and my folks made the sign of, on their mouths, with their fingers, not to make any noise, because they were both listening intently to the radio. Then my dad lifted up his head and said, the Japanese attacked us at Pearl Harbor. Well, now, I didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. I just knew that it was out in the Pacific someplace. That's all I knew. But the fact that the Japanese attacked us, you know, was enough for me.
And so, you were 10 days shy of your 20th birthday. So did it hit you immediately that this is something you were going to have to be involved in at some point?
Very shortly thereafter. I've been thinking about it, especially after my two buddies were picked up in the draft. I was working at Cutler and Hammer in Milwaukee. On the way to work, I said to myself, I'm just going to go down and enlist right now. So before I went to work, I went downtown to the federal building. I enlisted in the Army. I ended up getting my first choice armor, and that's how come I ended up in Camp Polk, Louisiana, because at that time, that was an armored training center just like Fort Knox. When we were done with basic training, we went out to the Mojave Desert for 4 months, and they were going to train us for North Africa.
Right.
So we get done with our training. We get back to our staging area, which was Camp Pickett, Virginia. And then they told us that we're not going to North Africa. General Montgomery, who was the British general of all the Allied forces in North Africa, managed to break Rommel's supply lines, and the whole German front was just collapsing over to Sicily and Sardinia and onto Italy, the foot of Italy itself. And so they didn't need a regular American armored division in North Africa. So they sent us from there up to Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania, kind of up in the mountains. At that point in time, it was into December, and snow all over the place. And we didn't have the rubber tracks for our tanks and lighter tracked vehicles, like our 81-millimeter mortars, of which there were three of them, were all mounted in mortar half-tracks. Well, the rear wheels operated with a track system, and you had regular wheels in the front. Well, the rubber tracks didn't come through yet, and so there were a number of severe accidents. Some of those mountain roads were pretty narrow, and the curves were pretty sharp. I saw one spot where a light tank, it had a crew of four guys. It went down over the edge and just cleared a path all the way down to, I don't know how far it rolled. And I never went down there, of course, but the guys were just shaken to pieces.
You were confronted, even in the States in training, with how dangerous this is going to be, with nobody shooting at you. Just the nature of moving these armored vehicles around is dangerous.
Yeah, they sent us over to Britain in September of 43, prior to the invasion, and we trained over there. We used to say we were the best trained outfit in the whole army.
Because you had so much time to train?
Yeah. When we sailed past the Statue of Liberty, I was at a railing on this ship, and I used to wonder, am I going to see that again coming back? Because a lot of my buddies, to my knowledge, are still over there in military cemeteries, unless their families had them brought back,
right,
and put in family plots. That happened, I know, in some cases. Other cases, the families felt that their sons or husbands or brothers, whatever it was, had close ties with buddies there. And that's true. You can't believe how close you are to your buddies. And so I think that's one way of thinking about it. Just let them rest in the military cemeteries.
Well, and there were some times where you came close enough to ending up in one of those, and we're going to hear about that. But is there anything else about those 8 or 9 months you spent in England for further training that stands out in your memories?
A couple of buddies and myself were in London on a 3-day pass. When they talk about London fog, they're not exaggerating. It's the thickest darn fog you ever saw in your whole living life. This was nighttime on top of it. We're walking on the sidewalk, going across the Thames River. Oh, holy man. Suddenly out of this fog comes this monster. And this one buddy of mine, he had a couple of drinks too many. He got so excited he jumped over the railing right into the Thames River. Well, he didn't realize it, but had this happened a little sooner, he'd have fallen right on rocks and stuff. But this way he fell into the water, and this big English bobby leans over the railing and says, "What the bloody hell are you doing down there, Yank?" Every so many yards across the bridge on both sides, they had life preservers with ropes, of course. This bobby threw it over, and he yelled down, "Crawl on this, Yank!" And that's where this bobby could have pulled him up with one hand. Oh, he was a monster. Oh, is he big.
So we saw this imposing figure in the fog, but it was just an English policeman.
It scared the bejeebies out of the guy.
And did you get a glimpse or an understanding of how much damage had been inflicted on England?
Oh, unbelievably. Unbelievably. We were stationed at a little town called Warminster, and that was between two real big cities. On clear nights, what the Germans would do when they'd leave their airports over in France, they'd climb as high as they could. When their engines wouldn't pull them any higher, they'd cut off their engines and then glide over these cities before they dropped their bombs. Well, then we'd watch the searchlights cross on them. In many cases, it was like watching fireworks, only the real thing, you know.
Yeah.
the guy that sit out on the steps of this barracks that we were in and watch this. It was something to behold. Sometimes German parachutists would drop out in our general area. My company was never called out to help search for them, but other companies in our regiment had been.
Hmm.
And they'd pick them up and just turn them over to the local police.
It's time for our first break, but we're just getting started with 95-year-old Ken Vincent of Waterford, Wisconsin. From Normandy through the rest of the war in Europe, we'll hear about his close calls as well as the memories of a concentration camp that he can't erase from his mind. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.